Hey y'all, it's Dr. Samina Rahman, Gyno Girl. I'm a board-certified gynecologist, a clinical assistant professor of OBGYN at Northwestern Feinberg School of Medicine, and owner of a private practice for almost a decade that specializes in menopause and sexual medicine. I'm a South Asian American Muslim woman who is here to empower, educate, and help you advocate for health issues that have been stigmatized, shamed, and perhaps even prevented you from living your best life. I'm better than your best girlfriend and more open than most of your doctors. I'm here to educate so you can advocate. Welcome to Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. Let's go. Hey, y'all, it's me, Dr. Samina Rahman, Gyno Girl. I am super excited today to bring you another episode. Before I do, just a reminder who I am. I'm Samina Rahman. I'm Gyno Girl. I have this podcast that's been going on pretty strongly for over a year. I'm in the process of merging with Ms. Medicine. So Ms. Medicine is a national network of concierge physicians. I'll be their first gynecologist. And so I'm looking forward to providing elevated care for my patients. So I'll be talking more about that. And I am also super excited because I'm working on this book that I've talked about to you guys. And so that should be coming out, hopefully. I'm going to reveal the cover soon. So you guys stay tuned. Today, I'm very interesting interview that I just completed with Dr. Mubeen Saeed. It is such interesting because I love history, but I also like understanding, you know, why things happen in medicine. And I'm always asking why. So I found him on social media a while back, started to follow him and listen to his concerns around cardiovascular disease in the South Asian community. So today we had a great discussion around all the things that we think have contributed to South Asian women. I always say that South Asians make up 25% of the world population, but over 60% of the world heart disease. So pretty profound. We die at earlier ages from heart disease. If you ever talk to a South Asian person, they have, you know, met or, you know, they have members in their family who have died prematurely. Or if you're a woman who's South Asian, you're most likely to die from your first heart attack, which happened to my dear mother. And so this physician is located in Ohio, Dr. Mubeen Saeed. We had a great discussion. He just finished a book that's being published, Healing from Our History, How Colonial Era Famines Led to a Modern South Asian Health Crisis, which is very true. And so just from his history, he is a nationally recognized physician with almost 30 years of experience, specializing in endovascular therapy. He is a health historian, a medtech entrepreneur, and a medical products inventor holding 28 patents. He is the author of a medical guide on pain treatment and two works focusing on the modern South Asian health crisis. He has been a TEDx speaker as well as featured on the Healthy Minds, Healthy Bodies PBS documentary and in the CNN, International, The Guardian, and HuffPost. So he's pretty cool. He's trying to heal from history because he's also experienced a heart attack, which he talks about a lot. And so it's very interesting to hear. One thing that, you know, like more than 1 million people have watched the CNN international video, Guardian story on how British colonialism increased diabetes in South Asians. I remember finding out that Pakistan, where my parents are from, is number one in diabetes. And I was like, anyone want a high five over this? But no one really did. So we're number one in diabetes, unfortunately, which means we have a lot of cardiovascular burden. But he published this Guardian story on how British colonialism increased diabetes in South Asia. And so he has now released this book, which is amazing. I'm waiting to get it. I don't know. I find it so interesting in how, I guess, you know, anytime you want to blame colonialism on something, you should, I guess. I'm just joking. But anyway, and I hope you enjoy this as much as I did. And I can't wait to get his book. You can read in the notes here on trying to get his information and how to get his book as well. But it's called Healing from History, How Colonial Era Famines Led to a Modern South Asian Health Crisis. So if you're South Asian, I think you'll find this very interesting. I think if you take care of South Asians, I think if you like history, I think if you just want to hear how someone overcame his own heart struggles and went and is doing something really unique in this space. So let's get at it. Hi, everyone. It's me, Dr. Samina Rahman, Gyno Girl. Welcome back to another episode of Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. I'm Dr. Samina Rahman, and I'm really excited to get a very unique perspective from someone I've recently met online. And I've been really intrigued by his work, as I talked to you guys about in the intro. And so I'm super excited to have Dr. Mobeen Sayed here to talk to us about so many things around cardiometabolic health that affects not only midlife women, but so many other women throughout their reproductive journey. So Dr. Mobeen Sayed, welcome to Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. How are you today?
Doing well. Thanks so much, Dr. Rahman.
Yeah, I'm super excited because I started following you on Instagram, like, I don't know, when did you get on? 2 years ago or something?
About 3 years ago, actually.
3 years, yes.
This would have been 2022. Yeah.
And, we'll put the handle on, but you're Desi Doc on Instagram. And as a South Asian woman, I'm very intrigued by so much of what you write about and talk about, how our epigenetics change with different types of traumatic experiences and trauma periods that affect different cultures. But first of all, I want to just talk to you about like what brought you into this like space around, colonialism and famines and how it affects our cardiometabolic health. Can you tell us our journey? I know you talk about it in your Instagram all the time.
Several years ago in 2018, I was working out and I basically, after the workout, I started feeling impending doom. I thought, maybe I'm just dehydrated. I've had this similar feeling when I've had bouts of gastroenteritis.
Yeah.
Typically have gone to the emergency room when I'm feeling really bad, gotten hydrated and felt fine.
Yeah.
I felt like, hey, maybe I can, should I decide between going home and just hydrating myself or go to the emergency room? Deciding that I was feeling bad, I thought maybe I should just play it safe, go to the emergency room, planning on getting some intravenous fluids, because I thought, okay, maybe I just didn't drink enough fluids, which is very likely.
Yeah.
And I picked out. And lo and behold, they told me I was having a heart attack, ST elevation. It's basically the worst kind of heart attack.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, I was just so confused. I thought,
you were like, 40 something, right?
Yeah, I was 52.
52, but still.
And I thought I was doing everything healthy. I mean, I was exercising. I thought I was eating right.
Mm-hmm.
But bottom line was, they were telling me I probably needed intervention by an interventional cardiologist right away. Ended up having 3 stents put in.
Wow.
And thankfully everything went smoothly. But afterwards, I kept thinking to myself, what's going on? I thought I was healthy,
Yeah.
And even my risk calculators, the 10-year risk calculators told me that my risk for coronary artery disease was very low.
Yeah.
And I was just so confused. And as I did more research, I thought, I got to figure this out.
Yeah.
I found out that, number one of the interesting things was I had a level in my blood test called lipoprotein small A.
Yeah.
It was sky high.
Yeah.
And I thought, where is this coming from? And I found out that one out of every almost like 44%, nearly one out of every two South Asians carry this, elevated lipoprotein small A, which predisposes to cardiovascular disease.
Yeah.
And I found in general that South Asians have 4 times the rate of diabetes, 4 times the rate of cardiovascular disease. The death rates are higher. There's premature onset of this disease by 10 years compared to other ethnicities, or especially compared to like Caucasians.
Mm-hmm.
It just seemed like there's got to be more to the story. I thought, okay, well, is it just our diet? Is it just our lifestyle?
Yeah.
But then when I found that there was differences in these research studies, even in young, healthy Caucasians and even in infants, there's much higher rates of insulin. The blood levels of insulin is higher even in South Asian
infants, huh? Really? I didn't know
I thought, okay, there's got to be something involving our genetics and what could have caused these changes. And I thought, let's look at our history.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was looking through our history, I noticed there's this huge amount of famines.
Mm-hmm.
And as I did more research on famines, I found there's a connection between famines and heart disease and famines and diabetes in multi-generational effects through epigenetics. been done in these other famines that were studied.
I'm sure most of the listeners probably have some idea, but if not, you know, obviously the British Empire ruled South Asia, the South Asian, like the multiple South Asian countries, the Indian subcontinent, I guess I would say, for hundreds of years.
Yes. Yeah. So you could say it started from 1757 until 1947, almost, let's say, 190 years, basically, of colonial rule of all of these major South Asian nations. And what happened is that compared to history since then, and compared to history even prior, the rates of famine skyrocketed under colonial rule.
Mm-hmm.
Numbers of deaths were huge. There was a study done by a recent study that found that the number of excess deaths just between 1880 and 1920 alone were somewhere between 100 to 160 million, at least, excess deaths.
Yeah.
And this was the height of British rule, when the famines were just rip-roaring through South Asian society.
Mm-hmm.
Tens of millions of deaths were occurring, as I just described.
Right.
And there was chronic undernutrition in between the famines.
Right. And so this power dynamic brought these, like, induced famines on the South Asian community, as we say, like, that was induced by the colonial rule, actually has a negative impact on our South Asian, like, to this day. And you know, we know this about slavery, too. We know that, like, you know, slavery has had such a dramatic impact on the African-American community that, you know, where Black women are more likely to have premature menopause and all these from an allostatic load, or the stress of, like, chronic, you know, systemic oppression and racism that we see that happens to them. And so we know that's studied in that population. So, and I was really acutely aware of that for a very long time, because I'm very interested in medical racism and implicit bias. And so when I started reading about what your studies, I was like, wow, look, see, I mean, another aspect of how really colonialism, racism in general, has really impacted our ability to care for our own health in some ways.
Yeah. And so, you know, with the colonial famines, with these repeated famines, our bodies that conserved calories survived. And one of the manifestations of this in the modern world for South Asians is insulin resistance.
Mm-hmm.
Insulin resistance is actually a starvation survival mechanism. And because you can think of it, insulin is basically the fat storage hormone.
Mm-hmm.
If you have higher than normal levels of insulin in your body, you're going to store more fat and therefore be more likely to survive a famine when there's no food around compared to someone else.
Right, right.
And as a result, but what happens is that in a situation of abundance, that works against you. That is what causes, you know, cardiometabolic disease, or, you know, the heart disease, the diabetes, skyrocketing numbers.
Right. Yeah. And so, and we all know that, you know, there's so much talk around visceral fat accumulation and cardiometabolic health, and how that fat around our intestines and in our visceral organs actually cause so much inflammation and negative aspects toward our overall cardiometabolic health. And so I was reading once that Pakistan's, like, number one in diabetes around the world. Like, like, the most and my parents are Pakistani, so they have, like, the most number of diabetics in the world, which is very telling, I think.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so that's interesting. But, yeah, it's not interesting. It's sad, actually.
It's sad.
Mm-hmm. But what we're talking about is, even at low BMIs, even apparently lean South Asians can carry very high amounts of visceral fat inside their liver, also not just around the organs, but inside their livers. And so it's been found that a South Asian person who looks lean with a BMI of 22 may carry as much fat, just because it's around their organs, because it's inside the liver, as much as a person who's white Caucasian origin or heritage with a BMI of 28.
Yeah. So I think that means that we need to look at our South Asian patients a little bit differently, right? Is the statistic true that we make up about a quarter of the world's population, but 67%?
Exactly. Yeah. and yet carry 60% of the world's cardiovascular disease burden.
Right. So that's, you know, that's heavy. I mean, I'm very careful with my patients who are South Asian, because we know, and, you know, I obviously take care of women as a gynecologist, but, you know, one of the aspects that I see in my office a lot in, you know, we'll start with premenopausal is like the PCOS phenomenon, right? One in four South Asian women have PCOS, and we see it. I see it all the time with lean patients who, you know, they don't meet the, you know, the standard phenotype that we used to learn, that, you know, obese with, you know, facial hair and all the things. Like, some of them are very lean and they're very fit, and they still have problems getting pregnant, and they still have problems, you know, doing a lot of things. I had Dr. Ruby Jelani on my podcast, who's a fertility specialist, and she herself talked about her own PCOS journey as a very lean, thin South Asian woman. But can we talk a little bit about how, do you think that then, obviously we know that PCOS has a genetic predisposition. And so,
but yeah, I think you're right in the fact that it affects like 25% of women. That shouldn't be happening. South Asian women, I'm talking about, a quarter of South Asian women. I think that there may be a connection between famine-shaped physiology with basically the root driver here is insulin resistance. You know, we know that insulin resistance is a survival mechanism in famine. And then the same insulin resistance, which pushes insulin levels high, drives the androgen, ovarian androgen production that's seen in PCOS. And I think that that's what causes, you know, South Asian women to have this syndrome.
Right.
Even if they're apparently thin, you know, they have this thin fat paradox going on where they may carry large amounts of fat in between their organs inside their liver. And, you know, the standard PCOS workup may miss a lot of the metabolic screening that should be done in South Asian women. And, you know, that may be something to consider doing.
If you're taking care of, or if you yourself are South Asian.
Like fasting insulin, blood sugar, you know, insulin resistance scores, hemoglobin A1C, lipids levels.
Yeah.
See if someone's unexpectedly, you know, has this.
Has this compromise, yeah. And I think there's actually a push in the like reproductive community to even change the name, because the name is such a misnomer for polycystic ovarian syndrome, when it's really a cardiometabolic dysfunction that's leading to, you know, ovarian or reproductive compromise and androgenic features. So I feel like, you know, it is, I always say it's such a joke that it's called polycystic ovarian syndrome, because the cystic ovaries have, you know, are just a secondary effect of what's happening from a cardiometabolic profile. And so I think that for patients that are listening who have this, you know, really should be looking at your whole cardiometabolic profile and not just, you know, your FSH, you know, your reproductive hormones or that kind of thing. I want to talk a little bit about the Masala study, because that's one of the biggest study that's always quoted around South Asians, right? I think that's what has kind of helped us understand some of the cardiometabolic effects when it comes to what happens to South Asians with their cardiovascular health.
Yeah. So I'm glad you brought that up. The Masala study, I think you were mentioning, about 33% entered menopause at less than age 45.
Yes.
And this was kind of a surprise. I know that there is a study that was done on the Chinese famine where they looked at when there was a prenatal exposure to the famine. These children had double the risk of premature menopause.
Oh, really? The children of the parents who went under
the famine survivors because of prenatal exposure. This is, again, maybe due to epigenetic change, which is something that may be passed down in multiple generations. And I suspect this may be something that's similar that's happening in South Asian women. And there may be a similar effect. But when you lose this estrogen protection, you do end up with higher levels of stroke and cardiometabolic disease risk. And I think that's something that is a serious problem. It needs to be, you know, South Asian women need to be screened for this at much younger ages, you know, at lower BMIs, and you know, it should be I think what you're talking about is hormone treatment maybe need to be considered at lower cutoffs.
Yeah. Actually, before we dive deeper into that, for the people that don't know the difference between epigenetics and genetics, can you just clear?
Oh, yeah. Good question. Yeah. So epigenetics versus genetics. So genetics, I'm trying to think of a simple analogy. Genetics is a change can occur in your genetics, like a mutation, where if you have a sentence written, the way you read the sentence is based on the letters, right? You can read it. Okay, so let's say a genetic change, which would involve a change in the letters or the word of the sentence. But epigenetic change is where you're keeping the sentence, the words the same, but you're changing maybe the pronunciation or the emphasis. So it's the expression. The way that these genes are expressed is different. So these can, you know, like think of it as punctuation, I guess. or underlining it or emphasizing it. So the letters and the words are the same. Yeah. The genetic, the code is the same.
The code is the same.
But the expression is now different.
Right.
And epigenetic change can actually occur in an entire population due to an environmental stress. And so there's different things. There's technical words for it, DNA methylation, changes in the histones or the way that these proteins are expressed. They can be affected by these by the environment. So your genes may be expressed differently if you're a famine survivor. And that's what this study found in the Chinese famine, is that your genes for, you know, the only explanation they could think of is that there must be some epigenetic change that causes this high level of population change in diabetes in subsequent generations.
That's so interesting, because I think, you know, that goes into, there's so much around this kind of discussion nowadays, you know, when it's either like what's happening in utero, what's happening in adverse childhood experiences, like these ACEs. There's so many things that can impact your, you know, your regular function, your sexual function, your physical state, your cardiometabolic health, that I think some people don't even think about the history as much. And I find that so fascinating because, you know, I guess it's very empowering for patients ultimately, because at the end of the day, you think that there's just something wrong with you. And even though it's more like, you know, you're a product of what has happened to your population of people. And so it's unfortunate that these things have occurred, but it is now very empowering to say like, okay, this is what I'm working against my genetic. I always say this all the time. Well, listen, I'm working against my genetics and epigenetics. So I got to make sure that like my diet is X or my, you know, my exercise routine is this.
Right. I think knowledge is power, and having this knowledge can make sure that you are extra careful, appropriately careful, I should say.
Yeah.
Based on your predispositions that you know to be ultimately based on your history.
Right.
And I think that's an important message that, you know, our genes remember the famines, but our lifestyles kind of forgot it, you know?
Yeah.
It's, and for South Asians, you know, metabolic health is not just molecular, it's historical. So you can't ignore the history.
You can't ignore the history. Yeah, that's very powerful. And I think that, you know, going back to the, you know, patients who are, you know, struggling with PCOS or the women entering early menopause, right? We always say the average age of menopause is 51 for, you know, Caucasian women, but, you know, not only Black women, Hispanic women, but South Asian women also experience it early. And, you know, as you said, when you experience menopause early, we know that women that enter with primary ovarian insufficiency, which is less than age 40, or premature menopause less than age 45, that up to 10 years of estrogen deprivation actually not only causes issues with their bone health, but makes them more at risk for cardiometabolic disease, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and early death, right? So I think that's really compelling to hear. And so that's why it's so important for these patients, especially the premature ones, to get, if they're able to get on menopausal hormone therapy, we know that's very beneficial. There's obviously, it's one tool in the toolkit. What do you tell patients about lifestyle modifications? And what do you think about metformin and the GLP-1s? Because I use them a lot on my patients with PCOS and the ones struggling with obesity.
Yeah, I think, you know, the GLP treatments are good crutches to get you where you need to be. But I think ultimately you need to change your lifestyle and your diet. Those are what are going to provide those long lasting, durable changes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's important to know that you need to, you know, this is was a surprise to me, but South Asians actually need significantly more exercise, mm-hmm. moderate intensity exercise mm-hmm. than what was thought to be, you know, for prescribed for everyone else. Mm-hmm. Some studies have, you know, usually the studies say 150 minutes of moderate intensity exercise mm-hmm. in a given week.
Yeah.
For South Asians, it may be closer to, you know, 200 to 266 minutes per week.
Wow.
232 to 266 minutes. Some, you know, so much higher than what you think, almost double.
Yeah. Yeah, almost double.
Just to maintain the same level of cardiometabolic health as someone else. The other thing is to be extra careful about your diet. I think that based on the research I've done, I actually did a paper in looking at all these studies as sort of a review paper about the differences in South Asian physiology.
Yeah.
And they found that, you know, the response to sugar is much worse in South Asians.
It makes sense.
It basically causes a much more of a greater lipemic effect in your blood.
Uh-huh.
So we have to be extra careful with the foods that we eat. And, you know, like South Asians became insulin resistant within 5 days of consuming, you know, a cup, basically equivalent of a cup of cream. Every day for 5 days, and they became insulin resistant, whereas nothing happened to the white Caucasians who did this every day.
Wow.
So it just tells you there's a big difference.
Yeah.
And these were young, healthy Caucasians that they did the studies. Sorry, young, healthy South Asians and young, healthy Caucasians that they did the studies on.
Uh-huh.
And we just, you know, need to be aware of this, these differences.
Yeah.
Our bodies are much less tolerant of the excesses.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And so what do you tell your patients who come in, like if you had a South Asian woman that was, you know, getting, you know, maybe hormonal treatment because she was already, you know, menopausal or perimenopausal, but she's really concerned about all the things that she read. She read everything you wrote and is like so concerned like what to do with herself. Like how to...
I don't think hope is lost at all. I mean, I think even in middle age, you know, like myself, you can still reverse the course.
Mm-hmm.
And this has been shown in even in other studies that you can change your diet and your health, your lifestyle, even relatively late in life, and it can have a major impact mm-hmm. on your ultimate health.
Yeah.
And so all is not lost. I think it's just important to do it whenever you can to make the appropriate changes and, you know, trying to eat right, avoid ultra-processed foods, avoid sugar, increase your intake of fiber to the recommended levels. You know, some people say like 25 grams for a woman, 30 grams for a man, at least.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to, you know, increase your make sure your protein intake is appropriate. A lot of South Asian diets tend to be, you know, very carb heavy
mm-hmm.
and deficient in protein. Realize that white rice is, you know, an introduced food into our diet.
Yeah.
And we need to kind of keep a check on how much white rice and white flour we intake in our body. And I'm talking about, you know, when we typically eat large amounts of white rice, thinking that's going to be good for us or satisfy us. It's really very bad. And you can even see it in a normal person who doesn't have diabetes, eating white rice will skyrocket your blood sugar.
Mm.
And it keeps it up for hours, many hours. It's not what we should be eating large quantities of.
Yeah.
And same thing with white flour
products. Yeah.
But I mean, and then exercise and then trying to reduce stress levels and even simple things like getting enough sleep at night.
Yes. The sleep is so critical.
This is like very important. And the other thing I would like to remind people of South Asian is that you need to make sure if you're having symptoms of sleep apnea,
mm-hmm.
which can be very much masked, that you need to get a sleep study and maybe get that treated.
Because
mm-hmm. That can really impair your ability to get a good night's sleep. And there is some data to suggest that there is some higher risk for South Asians, you know.
Yeah.
And try to reduce or manage stress levels in your life as much as possible. And I suggest things like yoga and transcendental meditation. Doing things like that are can be very beneficial for stress. And these are something that is part of our heritage. And getting enough exercise means, you know, also doing strength training or resistance right. exercises. That's very important because of our relatively low lean muscle mass that South Asians have a tendency towards. That's something that we need to maintain or try to enhance.
Yeah. That's one of the things I always tell my patients too. Try to get, you know, that 30 grams of protein per meal, try to get up to 30 grams of fiber per day, you know, mm-hmm. really get your cardiometabolic function improving, whether or not it's increasing your walking. I know you do a lot of like, you know, you always post about all the stuff that you do in terms of like, even, don't you have like a treadmill walker that you use?
Yeah, I try to actually walk outside as much as possible because, you know, that there's actually benefit to that. You know, green space exposure is really good for your mind as well as, you know, your stress levels, et cetera. But if you can't do it, treadmill is good. And I would say, you know, if you can do relatively brisk walking, it would be ideal. And I try to do resistance training at least twice a week.
Oh, wonderful. And what do you do on a day?
Like 30 minutes.
Okay. And then what do you do? Mm-hmm. Do you try to walk to the most places that you can? And
yeah, I try to walk. I try to take the stairs everywhere I go.
Do you count your steps? You know,
I do count. Yes, I do. I try, and I'm not saying this is what everyone needs to do, but for myself as a personal goal, I try to maintain at least 10,000 steps a day, like minimum, and I try to go more than that. And I think it really has helped.
Yeah, you're a little.
And it's also something that, you know, I used to run a lot. And for me, I didn't understand the dynamics in my body. I think when I was running at these, you know, higher speeds, my cortisol levels were probably increasing.
Yeah, and, that's true.
When that was happening, I was probably not, you know, I was fighting against my body in terms of trying to lose weight, trying to, you know, get rid of visceral fat. And I realized that when I'm walking, I'm actually calm and my cortisol levels do not increase. And I think it was better for me, not only for weight loss, but also to get that actual exercise that your body needs without hurting yourself. Because, you know, you can have injuries that you will get when you are running that you won't get with
your walking. Yes, absolutely.
Especially as you get older.
And I think it's very important because everyone wants to stay mobile. I always say nursing home prevention program is really making sure your brain is cognitively okay and you're not peeing all over yourself and you're mobile, right?
What you do now is what will have the impact when you're in your 80s.
Right, exactly. So the good habits should start now. What advice would you give anyone listening in terms of like, you know, if you're, obviously this can go for any race or, you know, that's not, you know, because especially for women, you know, there's a lot of literature suggesting how there's a lot of gaslighting that happens to women when it comes to their health and their pain needs and their overall function. And so a lot of my patients that come to me tell me that they just haven't felt listened to before. You know, maybe they've seen me or some other clinician that is able to. As a South Asian, do you feel that, is there any specific advice you'd give other South Asian patients who are trying to find someone to understand these unique concerns and needs?
Yeah, I mean, I think, unfortunately, right now, a lot of people, I mean, most of the research has been done on Eurocentric cohorts, you know, research and guidelines are built on that. So the risk for South Asians based on these standard Western medicine-based research underestimates their risk for South Asians by as much as 30%. And this underrepresentation, in research is the major problem. Even though South Asians are 25% of the world's population,
we don't like to get into research.
Well, they're just not included in the research.
I think it's a both problems. Whenever I talk to patients, like they have a distrust of the system in some degree, but they also aren't always sought after either by the research.
Yep. But I think there needs to be more South Asian centric health guidelines and more studies need to be done. And, you know, instead of centering the lens on Western bodies, it needs to be focused more on South Asians. So there is, unfortunately, that lacking, but but I think that there are enough studies and physicians should become more cognizant of the uniqueness of South Asian health parameters.
Yeah.
And there has been studies now and even some guidelines for South Asians that should be followed
right.
that are different from what is recommended for other ethnicities.
Right, because I think that the waist to hip circumference and the yes. BMI are mm-hmm. lower, right?
Right, like, you know, a waist circumference greater than 80 centimeters in a South Asian woman, it should be, they're at higher risk and they should be monitored. You probably need to check their things like their fasting glucose and their lipids at that point. And, you know, they should be considered for, you know, the risk for PCOS mm-hmm. or if maybe they're having premature menopause, all of this should be sought. And I know you're doing this type of stuff, but I mean,
yeah, people are listening. Yeah.
There should be an awareness for that. And you may have to find a physician who's sympathetic to
right.
to doing that type of research. But I think overall, if there could be some guidelines made specifically for South Asians, women,
yeah. Yeah.
you know, it would be important yeah. For all practitioners to know right. this because of the predispositions.
Yeah, absolutely.
That are
like I get very aggressive with my midlife South Asian patients. I'll do, you know, the panels that you discussed, you know, lipid, hemoglobin A1C, mm-hmm. fasting glucose. And I'm a yeah. gynecologist. I'm not an internist. So but like, I'm always like, right. if anything's abnormal, I'll send you back to your primary. But if this hasn't been checked, mm-hmm. let's check it. And sometimes if they're, yeah. you know, cholesterol and, you know, lipoprotein A, all that stuff, if all of these things are still okay, sometimes I even get their calcium. I'm like, just go get a calcium score. It's $49 at mm-hmm. this hospital and, you know, check it out. And
yeah.
sometimes you'll find someone and I'm like, well, you need to, you know, I don't manage those things, but at least I can get them screened. And then, you know.
Mm-hmm. That's great that you're doing that. I mean, you're amazing.
Sometimes why did you do a calcium score on this patient? And I'm like, well, she's like 43 and she's a South Asian whose mom died of, you know, a heart attack, you know. And
yeah.
so, but, you know, so, and then they get sort of some treatment that they need, I think, in that respect. Because the other thing is, and you know this, but in case the listeners don't, like, and I've talked to a cardiologist, I talked to Dr. Jane Morgan on my podcast about this, that, you know, women's symptoms often for, you know, heart attacks aren't always consistent with the crushing wolfen on yeah. your chest pain, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so by a lot of right. times people say they're atypical, but by othering the symptoms that women experience, they're getting neglected. So we should say these are common symptoms for women are not necessarily yeah. the crushing chest pain, right? It could be like these.
No, that's an excellent point. Yep. Even for my own, you know, heart attack, I, of course, it doesn't always have to be the classic crushing chest mm-hmm. pain radiating to your left arm. Mine was more of a sense of anxiety. And I think I was having some diaphoresis, but I just worked out, so I couldn't
yeah.
tell.
Yeah. Yeah. The sweating.
And it, but I think it's much higher for women to have these atypical symptoms.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, sometimes it's just the back pain. Sometimes it's like this acid reflux type of pain.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, these are the symptoms we should be aware of and just not say these are atypical. Like actually they're more typical for women to get these symptoms and we should not expect ourselves to be small men. And
mm-hmm.
So I always say, like, you know, it wasn't until 1993 right. that women were allowed in research, you know, so it's like,
Before
then, it was really like, oh, these women are small, you know, small men. So we'll just like, you know, mm-hmm. talk to them like that.
Yep.
But I think these are very important things to remember that, you know, if people haven't gotten these tests done or they haven't and they're entering these stages or if you're concerned about PCOS, you know, a lot of times, of course, you know, people get ultrasounds to look for those PCO ovaries, but we should be doing hemoglobin A1Cs and fasting insulin, and
yeah.
fasting glucose and mm-hmm. all the things because, you know, even if you don't have diabetes now, like you're just more at risk for it, right? You're more at risk for all the things.
Yeah. Right. There was even a study that showed that for people of Asian heritage, including South Asians, that you may have diabetes, even though your hemoglobin A1C is like 5.7. Because there was always this range where you're considered pre-diabetic only if it's like more than 5.7.
Yeah.
But there was a recent study and there's this, there is a endocrinologist in, I think, in California who's brought this research to light. And this was actually even featured on NPR, by the
oh,
way,
boy,
that there should be, like they're suggesting, based on this research, that an oral glucose tolerance test may be much more sensitive than a hemoglobin A1C.
Oh, wow. That's so interesting.
For someone who's got a hemoglobin, for A1C of like 5.7 or even 5.4.
Range. Like a 2-hour, like the, you know, we do.
Yeah, like the 2-hour test, especially given the appropriate clinical scenario, having the appropriate symptoms. Don't just say, oh, your hemoglobin is A1C is fine. You're not diabetic.
Yeah. And I think we have to be cognizant of the women in pregnancy too, right? When they, they're more at risk for gestational diabetes. And if they have gestational diabetes, mm-hmm. then they're more at risk for diabetes. Yeah. The same with preeclampsia. We know the hypertension thing is a big risk as well. I myself just started wearing a CGM.
Yes, I'm in the same boat, actually. I do it as well. It's helpful to just keep yourself a lot more accountable. And
you get alerted, glucose has just spiked. What did you eat?
Yeah, you definitely want to avoid the glucose spikes. And knowing that, you know, if you exercise, that it can really keep it under control.
Yeah, absolutely. I know it's controversial, but I think if you have a family history or if you're South Asian, I think that these things, I initially got it from.
And they are available now.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to have a physician to prescribe them. But I realize they're expensive and maybe not everyone can afford them, but it's something to consider if you have risk.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you so much, Mubin. This is a great conversation. And I feel like, this conversation isn't just for South Asians, because we all should be aware of our history. We should all be aware of how, you know, any kind of historical trauma that you or the ethnic group you represent, you know, might have experienced. And so, you know, like I said, we know this when it comes to African Americans and slavery, that they have had, you know, change in their epigenetics. The same is true for, you know, most of us that have been under these traumas. And so I think it's just worth understanding. Also, you know, there's plenty of clinicians that listen to my podcast, and it's really important for them to think twice about the brown person sitting in front of them to, you know, what might be experiencing or what they might need to get done. So I appreciate you bringing this to life.
No, I definitely echo what you're saying. It's...
And then let's just tell us a little bit about the book that's coming out. I pre-ordered it.
Oh, yeah, sure. thanks for mentioning that. So it's basically what I was trying to figure out is based on the South Asian health predispositions and the epigenetic changes, you know, what are some of these changes that have happened? And then what is the historical basis of the famines, you know, that caused these changes, or at least a significant portion of these changes to happen? And I was really basically curious. It's more of a history book, and it's something that's, it's not just for physicians to read, for instance. This is for everyone to be, who has interest in this, to read and understand, you know, how is it possible that what was once the wealthiest region in the world to become the poorest? Mm-hmm. And how did this happen over, you know, a space of close to 200 years? You know, how did it systematically happen? Become so poor? Because, you know, when I was growing up, South Asian countries were like the poster child for poverty.
Yeah.
And I was like, I felt very sad when I would visit, you know, and I used to wonder, and, you know, my mom used to tell me, you know, India used to be a very rich country. And I was like, are you kidding me? Yeah. How could that have happened? I didn't believe her until I read and didn't realize how, you know, how this could have happened. So it's just a matter of curiosity for me to understand how this could have happened over 200 years. What was the mechanisms? And I was surprised to find out, for instance, that, you know, huge amounts of, that there was actually enough food. It was just that billions of pounds of food was exported during the famines. So the famines were kind of artificial.
Yeah, they were induced, right? Because they were exported back to the British Empire, right? So.
Yeah, exactly. And
we'll keep our food and you guys don't get any, basically. The pillage.
It was just eye-opening. I mean, a lot of it was preventable. I think that the emphasis was too much on producing cash crops rather than food crops for the people. Yeah. It was more for food. It was more for export. The taxation structure favored producing cash crops for export rather than for native or local consumption, you know? the deindustrialization that happened on a massive scale. India was actually a, you know, some people would say industrialized or proto-industrialized country with 25% of the world's GDP, similar to the United States today, for instance. It was a place where people sought, you know, they wanted to live in India. They came from all over to live in India. And it was a very, it was a center of technology. And all of this deindustrialization that happened basically converted to a, you know, an agrarian society.
Absolutely.
And a consumer of goods instead of a manufacturer that it once was.
No, it's amazing.
And I was just curious about the economics of how this all happened. And it was just, it's really, I wanted to understand it. And that's what this book was about.
Actually, because I'm trying to complete my book too on, you know, sexual health from a South Asian lens. And one of my chapters, I talk about how pre-colonialism, you know, even sexual education and discussions around like sex within the context, you know, of marriage and in Islam, as well as in Hinduism and other South Asian communities, was very prolific. And there was, you know, erotica that was written that was very much like, you know, accepted as like, and then, you know, when the sort of puritanical values of Catholicism and all of the, you know, colonial powers came to be, they kind of just shut it all down, you know?
Right. Yeah. The cultural sensibilities of the imposed culture became the norm.
Yes, exactly. So I think it's very interesting to see that as well, because, you know, for most people, they think of South Asian women and in a like very shrouded in shame and, you know, all the things. And unfortunately, like, you know, the conditions of women in that country and those countries are still, you know, under always surveillance because of violence that's happening within it because of patriarchal norms that are still there. But I feel like, you know, understanding that history can be like, wow, you know, that wasn't part of who we really were initially. It gives you a sense of pride that, you know, but also sadness too. Because you're like, wow. But I appreciate everything you're doing and I appreciate your, because like I said, I found you on social media and I was like, wow, really? And so then I took a deep dive too. So, you know, you're doing
some, thank you so much.
You're doing some good work.
This is a great opportunity. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Dr. Syed, for joining me today.
An honor.
Yeah, it's really great. I'm Dr. Smita Rahman, Gyno Girl. Thanks for joining me on this episode. Please like and subscribe to my channel. Remember, I'm here to educate so you can advocate for yourself. Please join me on my next episode.
If you have a second, please subscribe to this podcast. I'd love for you to be a follower and learn as much as you can about the things that we're going to talk about with all the people on our journey. Please review us on Apple or Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. These reviews really help. Review us. Comment, tell me what else you want to hear to get more information. My practice website is www.cgcchicago.com. My website for Gyno Girl is www.gynogirltv.com. My Instagram is Gyno Girl, so please follow me for some good content. Additionally, I have a YouTube channel, Gyno Girl TV, where I love to talk about all these things on YouTube. And please subscribe to my newsletter, Gyno Girl News, which will be available on my website. I will see you next time.